Well, hey there, Sugar. This here is Rogue, and you are listening to Comics in Motion.
Greetings, everybody. Welcome to episode 6 of Examining X-Men 97, the weekly show where we look at the fantastically received new X-Men 97 animated Marvel series. Now, this week is a little bit different. I'm here, as always, one of your regular co-hosts, Max, but my other regular co-host, Spider-Dan, is unfortunately not going to be with us this week and the following week. He's in sunnier climes for a couple of weeks. Good luck to him. I'm very jealous because the weather is, to put a finer word on it, shit in the northwest of England at the moment. Stormy, rainy and cold and miserable. And that's just me. So unfortunately, Dan won't be with us, but he is going to contribute to this episode because at the end we're going to play some audio that he's recorded as of today with his sort of monologue style thoughts on the show. So we'll get his thoughts at the end. But in one's hour of need, one has to call in for special reinforcements, and we've come up trumps this week and next week. We're very, very privileged and proud to have with us an extremely special guest, the exciting, extraordinary and all-round excellent Homo Superior. It's, if you will, the Charles Xavier of the Comics in Motion Network. It is, of course, none other than the fabulous Mr. Dave Horrocks with an X. Dave, how are you, sir?
I am very good. You know, you always say, oh, I'm totally unprepared, and then you rattle off a whole bunch of puns, and I'm just, in comparison, you know, massively unprepared. But I will throw out the old chestnut and will say I'm very excited to be on here and talk to you. It's been great to follow along, you and Dan, and you've both got such deep knowledge about the X universe and all things comics, and so it's good to come off the subs bench, you know, dust off the boots and sort of limber up on the sidelines, and I'm ready to go.
Absolutely brilliant. Well, when I say underprepared, I mean I can always blag the start, but when it comes to the actual the meat of the episode, the discussion, that's where I'm like, oh shit, what am I gonna say next? But yes, as I said, Dave, we're absolutely privileged to have you here, and I'm very, very grateful to you for giving up your time. Now, as I said at the start, this is episode 6 of this fantastic series, Life Death Part 2, which is a belated follow-up to episode 4. So we've had the epic episode last week, remember it, but this is harkening back to the events of episode 4. But before we start discussing that, as we did when we had Tonya on a couple of episodes back on episode 4, we asked Tonya about her history with the X-Men and, you know, how she first came across the X-Men, be it in whatever form of media that was, and what, you know, what drew her to it. So I need to know from you, Dave, because I've never asked you this question. I'm quite intrigued to know. Tell me, what was your first experience with the X-Men way back when? And, you know, what was it about them that sort of, you know, drew you to them, so to speak?
Well, Max, we're going to go way back. So if you can think of the black and white TVs and the, you know, the like the Hovis adverts, you know, you have the old down with me whip it and the cobbled streets and stuff. No. Yeah. So it was actually, I can pinpoint this one. It was 1986. And I remember, so I was 10 years old, and I went up to the local newsagents. I don't even think it was John Menzies. I don't even think John Menzies was around then. But just in our little town, I just went up to the newsagents, and I was looking for, you know, some comics to kind of entertain myself. Remember that when kids had to entertain themselves? I mean, we're that latchkey generation, aren't we? So, you know, your parents just fuck off and just leave you to your own devices. It must have been the school holidays or something. And yeah, so just went up. And it used to be the times, I mean, now you have to go to a specialist comic book shop, don't you? And comics are really expensive. Whereas at the time, you know, they were still fairly cheap. And went up. And the thing is, I would have loved to have grown up in the US where you had access to regular comic supplies because they were never that regular. You know, the ones that you could get regularly, do you remember things like Spider-Man and Zoids? Things like that. I always remember getting that. But this particular time I got there and I was looking across the different comic selections and I saw this cover of this group. And it was Classic X-Men number one with the Art Adams cover on it. So you had Wolverine at the front, you had Colossus behind him, you had Nightcrawler there, you had Storm kind of flying up, you had Havoc in the back. And I was just like, oh, what is this? You know, and by the time you got to 10, you by osmosis, you're just exposed to your Batmans, your Spider-Mans, your Supermans. Of course, the movies were very popular in my house, but this almost felt like something that I discovered. I hadn't heard, no, I didn't have any friends that mentioned X-Men to me or anything. It was just literally that cover that grabbed me in. I was like, oh, I'm gonna have a read of that. And then you start to read it, and it's a great Classic X-Men number one is just a reprint of Giant Size number one. Well, Giant Size. And so you go through this story. And it's basically, you know, Xavier's putting together all the team and stuff. And I don't know what it is. There's just, I love that birth of a team, you know, going off and finding these different aspects, you know, these people with different skills and different personalities as well. It's like, oh, well, this Wolverine chap is there. And then you got Colossus and stuff. And you get these very rapid origin stories, you know, where you know, he's saving Ilyana, which obviously gets retconned years after. Well, most of it gets retconned actually. And then you're like, oh, this Sunfire fella seems a bit of a dick, you know. And then Nightcrawler, you get his kind of origin. I was just fascinated by it. And the thing is, it came with that feeling as well. I had discovered the X-Men, you know? At least in my little town. Because like I say, no one told me about it. And from that moment, I was just hooked. And, you know, off went the Spider-Man and stuff. And, you know, Wolverine. Because with Batman and with Superman, let's pick on Superman a little bit. You've got a tiny bit of yellow, but he's predominantly blue and red, isn't he? And then you've got Wolverine, and he's kind of this bright yellow. And in the 80s, fuck me, that was great. You know, big shoulder pads and yellow leotard and stuff. He just looked great. Fucking claws coming out of his knuckles. You know, he just really captured my imagination. And so I can't help it, even though most people have probably grown a bit like, oh, fucking Wolverine, I've seen enough of him. I still can't help it. I still fucking love the character, even though 100% he's been overused and it pisses me off when he's in 10 different books and they can't really evolve the character at all. And they massively overpower him these days as well. He can basically be shot to an amoeba or something like that and then regrow himself. Whereas if you go to the Claremont run, you know, he's kind of all right, he can accelerate his healing, but not to a ridiculous level where you know, he can be a pile of goo and then regrow himself. So yeah, I just love them. And then by the time the animated series came out, you know, I was probably about 16 then, so I was probably, you know, a bit too old for watching cartoons. He says, as you know, pushing 50 and still watching cartoons. At the time, I felt like I should be growing out of it, but again, I was watching it and thinking, oh, this is great. And the thing is, because you got those comics erratically, I mean, there was two problems really that stopped me from reading a good solid run back in the 80s. One was just the comics weren't there. So if you got to a story, you'd come back next week, you found out when comic delivery day was, you come and just fucking didn't get it. It's like, fuck's sake. So, all right, I'll get something else then. But, and like I say, the Marvel UK stuff was generally a bit more reliable. But so you end up with these massive gaps in your knowledge. And so you go years. And so it's through the animated series, you learn a bit more about the different stories. And then It was only the second blocker was just money. I mean, even though comics were cheap, you know, money was quite hard to come by. You know, you didn't have that much disposable income. So when it got to the animated series, that helped, you know, plug in some of the gaps in my knowledge. And then obviously you get older and things like Marvel Unlimited, I still think that is fantastic. You can go back and read all them all and fill in your knowledge and stuff. But if I was to place myself anywhere, I'm not sure if you wanted quite such a long explanation. I am such a Claremont fanboy. I mean, that Claremont run is my X-Men. And really, you know, this animated series is all about the Claremont run, isn't it? That's where it's taken. But when you got into the 90s and you started, you know, it started getting all a bit fucking Rob Liefeld, and, you know, you got these mad characters with the massive guns, and I'm not Cable's biggest fan, if I'm honest. You know, for me, it's around the mutations, and I like things that are grounded. Whereas in the 90s, it got a bit mad. And then the popularity, you know, exploded, didn't it? You know, with all the, like, the Liefeld stuff, the Jim Lee stuff. And the problem is it goes from being that band you discovered, you know, by yourself to, well, everyone suddenly likes them. And it's like, not cool anymore for me. But yeah, in terms of comics, I definitely have a lot of love for the X-Men.
Oh, brilliant. That's what a great story. Yeah, it's a lot of little parallels with myself there and things I used to like back then as well. So that's really great stuff. I mean, yeah, like you said, the animated series really sort of pushed it to places it had never been before. And then this new version, well, it's not a new version, this continuation of the original series is, again, just putting the X-Men levels of popularity to just new heights right now. Everyone's talking about it. I mean, you know, obviously we've talked in previous episodes of this show ad nauseum about the original series. But in terms of coming from the original series to this direct sequel, how do you think it's stacked up between what we've had before and what we're getting now? For me, I think it's been a almost seamless transition from one to the other in terms of, you know, tone and storytelling and that. But just with it's been given a fresh coat of paint, hasn't it?
Yeah, I think it's been brilliant, to be honest. And I do think, you know, the MCU has stuttered a bit, hasn't it? You know, ultimately under that Disney ownership, and they've flooded us with a bit of content. You know, one of their big growth engines is obviously Disney Plus. They want subscribers. The stock market looks at that sort of stuff. So rather than, you know, growing this movie verse, it's become more about getting new subscribers. And I think they have stumbled a bit, you know, in terms of quality. If they'd have released half of the stuff, I'm sure it would have been a lot better. And it's a bit mad because I never, ever thought I could have too much, but I have. But this, this animated series, like you say, it's a new coat of paint. I love the fact that it still looks hand-drawn. You know, since Toy Story, really, you've had a complete change in animation. It's all computer generated now, and I'm sure there is some of that in there, but this all still looks hand drawn. But the lines are a bit crisper, the colors are a bit brighter. It just looks really good. And you know, I think the episode last week was one of those proper holy shit moments. You know, that was a proper Game of Thrones Red Wedding kind of moment, wasn't it?
It really was. I think everyone's been talking about last week's episode. I think they've really sort of gone all out with who they killed off in that episode. I mean, we went through it last week, so you don't worry about spoilers. We can talk freely about who's dead and who's alive. And as well, we'll talk about the episode we're about to talk about in full depth. So again, spoiler alert, anyone out there who's not seen it, listen to this, and you're precious about spoilers, stop this listening now and go and watch it and then come back, because things will be spoiled for you. But yeah, I mean, the balls to kill off, you know, Gambit and seemingly at least Magneto. I mean, there's a bit of a, you know, air of mystery there, because we don't see a corpse, do we? But you know,
end of season, we're gonna see evil Magneto again. That's what I'm thinking.
we're going to see something, aren't we? Yeah. But those two deaths is the perfect way to start off talking about this new episode because they've changed the opening credits yet again, haven't they? They've been doing this throughout. You know, the first episode had Bishop as a member of the team. And then once he had to go into the future to save baby Nathan, that's him out of the equation. Then obviously once Magneto popped up at the end of that first episode and said, oh, I've inherited it all from Charles. It's all mine. Ha ha ha. Then he's in the opening credits. But we get all change again this week. So obviously Magneto's out of there. Gambit's out of there. But we've got a new one in the fact that Nightcrawler's in there. So, again, just that little bit of, it's not much, but even that opening credits, the fact that they keep changing up every week, keeps you interested, doesn't it?
It absolutely does. And, you know, this isn't something special for this series, but Disney Plus always prompts you with the, you know, skip the intro. Fuck off. You know, I'm listening to that bad boy every single time, but the fact that they do change it a little bit makes it really good.
Yeah. Oh, it does, without question. I mean, you know, I think anyone who wants to press skip intro at that bit is a fucking idiot, to be honest with you. Not, you know, not to put too fine a point on it, but Jesus Christ, why would you? You know, especially when we're living week to week with this, aren't we? This is not binge TV where they've put all 10 episodes dropped at once and you can literally watch them one after the other after the other. We're literally living on a weekly basis here. So why, you're only getting this intro once a week. So why on earth would you skip it? You know, you'd have to be mad. It's one of the most iconic theme tunes ever, isn't it? I think.
Yeah, I absolutely love it. But it's funny, isn't it? Just any kind of storytelling, though, or any, not just storytelling, but any entertainment, really, it just evolves. And I'd mentioned about the Red Wedding and Game of Thrones. You see, I've got my House Stark t-shirt on here. So winter is coming. So massive sort of Game of Thrones fan as well. But the intro for that TV series also, you know, in the opening credits, again, another fantastic theme tune, but you would go to different parts of Westeros or, you know, or wherever, you know, north of the wall. And it was usually a clue to, oh, what's going to be in the episode. And I think here, it's the same thing again. You know, you get to see a little bit of, obviously, Nightcrawler. You get him, he's formally introduced as part of a team. I mean, X-Men is really quite fluid, isn't it, in terms of who's really on the team and off the team at any given time. But you're going to get a bit of the Nimrod and Bastion in there in the opening credits as well, and Cable. And so, yeah, there's enough going on in the opening credits to make you think, oh, I wonder what's coming in the episode. And honestly, when we get into the episode, it is a bit different to what I was expecting, to be honest. But I'm sure we'll get into a bit more of that.
Yeah, well, the episode itself is very much like last week's in that it's like two separate parts of the scenario, is it? It's like a split narrative. You've got something going on in one area and something going on in the other, whereas last week it was the events of Genosha coupled with the events back at the Manor with the documentary filming the film piece for the X-Men. Whereas here, it's a direct sequel to episode 4 where we're picking up where Storm and Forge left off, where his sort of ill-fated attempt to restore her powers was foiled by the adversary, and there's them trying to remedy that situation. But the meat of the episode, we'll talk about that in time, but the meat of the episode is the reintroduction to the series, finally, after six episodes, I should say, of Charles Xavier, of course. And it's a great link back to the way the original series ended. If people can remember the original series, the very last episode of that, where Charles on his literal deathbed is taken by Lilandra of the Shi'ar away because only their advanced medicine and healing apparatus can save him from impending death. And, you know, a year has passed since then. But what an opening, eh? It literally, we were thrown in right into the middle of the Kree Shi'ar war. And it's that opening shot. It's like something out of Star Wars, isn't it?
It is.
And, you know, I've just waxed lyrical about how I love the X-Men, but I have to say, X-Men in space, not really a fan. You know, I think the Shi'ar are a bit Shi'ite, to be honest. And so I don't like my X-Men in space. And so the fact that, you know, the Shi'ar are so entwined, and especially in Charles's life, you know, that romance between him and him and Lalandra. You know, he gets around a bit, Charles, doesn't he? He's a bit of a player, I think.
Yes.
But yeah, I don't know how I feel about it. I could have done with this whole season not having Charles in it at all. And actually, I guess the first thing I would say is you get to this episode. And I thought, actually, a couple of episodes ago, I thought the fact that you had the first part of Life Death in there, it was a weird creative choice, wasn't it?
Mm.
You know, you had the Jubilee and Sunspot stuff. And I went back to watch, you know, before we recorded, I went back to watch that. And it's basically like 5 minutes at the end, a little bit of Storm and Forge. But I feel like they've really cheated us of this story. I think I want to be critical. I don't want to be critical, but I am going to be critical.
Yeah.
I think the way they've split up Storm and Forge's story there is pretty terrible, to be honest. It could have been this whole episode. Just give us the whole episode. And you know what? If it's 20 minutes, it's 20 minutes.
Mm.
And link up the Xavier Shi'ar stuff, maybe with the Jubilee story that we had a couple of episodes ago. I don't know, maybe that was on the lighter side of the whole season arc, though, so okay, I can get that, but it just feels like been a bit short-changed with you know, there was no real reason to have these two parallel stories, because the only thing that links them together is they both become aware of the events on Genosha from the last episode, you know, around about the same time. And then, you know, presumably they're going to turn up, you know, and not rescue the X-Men, but at least reconvene with all the X-Men there. So I don't know. I enjoyed the episode. Don't get me wrong. I just feel like I'm still... It's one of those things, you know, when you think, but why? Why is it like that? I don't understand the creative choice to basically give us half a story. Whereas, you know, okay, just give us that time. Give that, you know, love story. But also, you know, did Storm really have to get her powers back so soon? You know, there's so much more to Storm than just her powers. So it would have been interesting, you know, if she had gone back to the X-Men and you know, hadn't got her powers. Spoiler alert as well, Max did warn you.
Feel free.
So I don't know. I just felt a little bit shortchanged. And it was a bit of a surprise, like you say, when you turn up at the start and it's straight in, you've got Deathbird in there. She's attacking the Kree. The other thing that jumped out at me actually at the start of this episode is the fact that you've got Ronan the Accuser there. And it's been a little bit of a question in my mind. So obviously when Fox had complete creative, or you never have complete creative control, but, you know, pretty much carte blanche to change things around a bit. I do wonder how much they're going to be constrained with the overarching MCU. And so when Ronan shows up, I'm like, oh, well, you know, that's a character that's definitely crossed into the MCU. Who's in
Guardians of the Galaxy. Yeah, first one.
I'm going to get the Guardian in here as well. Funny sort of way it comes back. But yeah, so I thought it was good. But, you know, like I said, I just don't... what do you think about the Shi'ar and the Kree and the... Obviously, we don't get the Skrulls in this, but...
No. I mean, the fact that we don't really need to see the Kree Shi'ar war, because it's not servicing the plot of the X-Men. I mean, I completely agree with your point about how we're basically getting 30-odd minutes of episode here just to get to the point where you can bring Storm and Charles Xavier back to the main fold by them stumbling across news of what's happened on Genosha. It seemed like a lot of runtime to get to that point where you really didn't didn't need to have it. I mean, that being the case, the Kree Shi'ar War is completely sort of redundant to the plot of this overall arc of the X-Men. But I did like the fact that we got to see, Ronan getting his ass kicked by the Imperial Guard, and just to see those characters from the Imperial Guard on the screen. You know, you've got Gladiator, you've got Titan, and the one that a lot of, and I know you picked up on it as well when we've been speaking before recording, was the fact that you get Vulcan in there. And it was such a minute appearance from him. He didn't speak. No one spoke to him. Yep. He did next to nothing. He was kind of just there. But that is a potential that if they can expand on that character based on who he is, what his family tree involves, I suppose for anyone who doesn't know, we'll say it for anyone who perhaps needs bringing up to speed in it. But Vulcan's real name is Gabriel Summers, right? Now, obviously Summers, Scott Summers, Cyclops, there's a family connection there. He is Cyclops's brother. And he'd never met him before this point. He's not even aware of his existence. Because obviously, if they expand upon it, whether this is just a throwaway cameo, a bit of fan service, or whether they end up expanding on it in later episodes or even later seasons, because this show is going to run for more seasons than this. But in the comics canon, Cyclops is in a plane with his brother Alex, who becomes Havoc, and the mum and dad, when the plane is inadvertently attacked by a Shi'ar ship on Earth. And there's only one parachute on board, so his mum wraps the parachute around the two boys, tells them to hold on to each other, and pushes them out of the aircraft. Well, you would do, I suppose, because it's their only chance of survival. And her and the father are presumed dead, but her and the father are actually taken by the Shi'ar. And unbeknownst to, I guess, Scott and Alex, that Mother Summers was pregnant at the time with Gabriel. Mm. And when he is, I think she's killed in canon. I can't remember now. I think she's killed by the Shi'ar, by Dakan, but they take the unborn baby from, out of her body, and then he's, taken somewhere in Shi'ar headquarters and experimented upon and what have you. And then that's expanded upon. And in fact, that's in a run that you mentioned the other day, isn't it? Deadly Genesis. You're a big fan of that one, aren't you?
I am. And it's a funny way I came across that. So it was at some point in the 2000s, I just bought a massive box, like random box of X-Men comics. Probably there were about 5% of just other random shit. But mostly it was X-Men comics. And Deadly Genesis was in there, the first issue. I was like, oh, what's this? And then it goes back to that familiar story from Giant Size and completely retcons it. You know, the X-Men weren't the first, or the X-Men that we knew, the Giant Size team, was not the first team that Xavier had sent there. And, you know, part of that was Vulcan, like you say, Gabriel Summers. And he's quite a sympathetic character. And I'm trying to think back now. It's been years since I read it, but I'm sure it's quite brutal. I'm sure they basically ripped Gabriel out of the mother. So I don't think she was dead. I think that was what killed her, kind of thing. Right. And so I could be wrong on that. Like I say, it's many years since I've read it, but I just remember really enjoying that story. And again, there's lots and lots of things. And I have not read every single X-Men comic. I don't know if it's possible to do that.
No.
I'm sure some people have, but the way it splinters off, and you've got 20 different X-Men books. It was the 90s, really, wasn't it, where they figured out, it's possibly Mutant Massacre. That was the thing where, you know, you had this cross book story, and then Marvel's like, oh, holy shit, you know, if you have this story across all the books, then people buy them. So then you just have all these X-Men books, and it's too much for me to keep up with. But you know, this one was a really great story, and like I say, for whatever reason, even though I know a lot of people don't like it because it retcons that original Giant Size story. But I did like it, and there's lots of the different arcs where you're like, it makes you kind of rethink Xavier's virtue. You know, you kind of think of, you know, the Patrick Stewart, you know, fatherly figure. He's got everyone's best interests at heart. You know, Magneto's the baddie and Xavier's the goodie. Whereas I even now, even it's sort of tainted my opinion of Xavier, and which is why my handle here is Xavier is a dick. I do think Xavier is a bit of a dick, and that's part of the reason I didn't really want him to go back to Earth and just let the X-Men do their thing. You know, the animated series Wolverine and the X-Men, it was not for me quite as up to the standard of this series. No. But I like the fact that they did just go in a different direction. You know, Emma Frost took a much more prominent role in that. Obviously, Wolverine, as the title suggests, I kind of liked how they took that. But yeah, I think they're probably going to make, in this animated series, probably going to keep him, you know, the cuddly father figure. But in the comics, his kind of motives are really quite questionable.
Yeah. Well, I like that too. I don't like Xavier as like kind of like the almost monk-like saintly figure. You know, I do like it's, I mean, I don't want him to be a complete arsehole, but I like that. I like characters with a shade of grey to them, you know. That's why I'm drawn to Batman. He is, you know, his methods sometimes do cross a line, you know. So that's the characters that I like. So I'm all for that kind of depiction of Xavier. It just adds a bit more colour to the character and a bit more depth. So I like it.
Yeah, I mean, I'll be a probably complete hypocrite now. When I was talking about my love for the X-Men, I have to say, I mean, if I talk about greatest villains of all time that I love, Darth Vader's probably top of the list, to be honest. Second to that is probably Magneto.
Yeah.
I fucking love the Magneto character. And like I say, you know, if you're talking about favorite X-Men characters, I'd probably have Magneto top of my list because, again, I'll go back to 1986 when Secret Wars came out, which I'm sure we'll see on screen. They'll do it in some way. But I remember watching it reading it as a kid. And, you know, they have the goodies on one side, the baddies on the other.
Yeah.
And they're all put there by the Beyonder. But they put Magneto with the goodies. I remember thinking as a kid, I'm like, that makes no sense. And he has a bit with Wasp. Again, he's another one, isn't he? Sly old dog Magneto. Oh, he gets about a bit.
He's put it about, yeah.
You know, in this series as well. I mean, I didn't actually know if him and Rogue were up to anything, but Xavier says in this episode, he was like, no, they were listening to music. They were playing music, making love.
Yeah, like, making love, yeah.
Bit of a weird thing to say, Charles, but okay.
How does Charles know? How does Charles know?
He's been fucking, you know, in people's heads, hasn't he? Yeah.
Some psychic voyeurism or something like that.
Exactly, but I feel like Magneto is so sympathetic, given his backstory and what he's been through. Wouldn't he be, you know, very suspicious of governments and motives and how evil people can get, you know, and people just following orders and stuff like that? Whereas, you know, Xavier is supposed to be this whiter than white character, but then, you know, he puts himself forward as this monk, but when it's convenient, you know, he'll interfere with people's free will and stuff. And that's where, so I've got more sympathy for Magneto because I think he's understandable. Whereas, you know, Xavier's a bit of a hypocrite. He's like, oh, this is the righteous path and whatever. But when it's convenient, you know, he'll bend the rules a little bit.
Oh, absolutely he will. Yeah. And he's certainly been up to a bit, we find out, during the course of this episode, because this is a year since Lilandra took him from Earth. So we learn that, you know, she makes this announcement to the Shi'ar folk, if you will, that Xavier is going to be her husband, I guess. They don't specifically. They do actually. Yeah, they do say we're going to get married. So yeah, he's going to be the sort of king to her queen of the Shi'ar. And obviously we see the resistance from the Shi'ar, because he isn't a Shi'ar, obviously. He's an Earthling, or a Terran, as they like to call it, which is...
Another reference to the main MCU, wasn't it? Mm,
yeah, Guardians of the Galaxy, that term gets thrown around a lot, doesn't it? People from Earth are known as Terrans. And it's quite interesting to see where he's at. You know, he seems really happy, actually, with his lot in life, doesn't he? He's not, like, miserable and... massive. He mentions the fact that he'd like to see his old X-Men, and she's like, you should invite them to the wedding, Charles, and all this. But he's having a great old time up there, isn't he? You know, he's wearing this exoskeleton.
He's not missing them that much, is he?
He's bloody not. He's wearing this exoskeleton so they can, you know, project this image of him sort of being, you know, able-bodied and what have you. And they're up to it. Sounds like they're at it as well, quite a bit as well, him and Lilandra. There's one bit where they're walking through like the Shi'ar hall, and they make a reference where he says, you know, they think of you as my pet, Charles. And he goes, a not entirely disagreeable situation.
I saw that.
Or something like that.
I was like, what is this kinky shit going on here? Yeah. Fucking leading you around the bedroom with a dog collar on or something. I thought it was a weird little sexual line by Charles there.
Yeah, there's definitely, you know, they're obviously up to all kinds of weird shenanigans on Shi'ar. So yeah, he seems pretty happy with his lot in life, doesn't he? But it's quite interesting to see the resistance to him from the Shi'ar. And then obviously he's made to do this, you know, the Deathbird, who is obviously Lilandra's sister, who we see as, like, you know, leading the charge in the aforementioned war. She says, you know, you've got to prove your loyalty to the Shi'ar. You've basically got to do this thing they call the what do they call it now? The Rite of Emda Shah, where he's got to basically purge all memories of his time on Earth and his, you know, his relationship with the X-Men. Basically, wipe his kind of slate clean and become, for all want purposes, a Shi'ar. And he's actually willing to do it as well, isn't he? He's resistant, but he's actually going to go through it, isn't he, for his love for Lilandra, before obviously all hell breaks loose and he's made to sort of change his way of thinking. But it's interesting whether he, you know, I suppose he is happy, but I don't know whether Charles Xavier would do that. I mean, it's one thing to find happiness, but it's another thing. You know, the X-Men is his life's work, isn't it? His almost sort of, you know, it's his life's work, his crusade to help mutant kind, you know, coexist with regular humankind, if I want of a better word. So I don't know, would he be quite so, I mean, obviously he loves the woman, I suppose, so you do things you do for love, but I don't know, would he do that? I'm not sure. What do you think?
That's a good question. I mean, it's almost like the Matrix blue pill or the red pill, isn't it? You know, he could come back to Earth and his life's work was, you know, to basically see that mutants and humans can coexist.
Yeah.
And he almost was killed by someone who he's trying to coexist with. So it's like, oh, fuck this, you know, can I just live out my days? I mean, he's no spring chicken, is he? You know, just live out my days here, you know, with doing some kinky shit with Lilandra, I'll be all right. So, I don't know. It was a temptation there.
Mm.
I mean, watching it, I never think he's going to go, yeah, fuck this. But let's face it, you're watching The Matrix and you're like, yeah, Neo, take that fucking pill. You see what The Matrix is.
Yeah.
But when you're a lot older, you're looking at it and you're going, ah, fuck it, stick me back in the Matrix. It's shit out here. I'll be cypher. It's fine. So, I don't think it was ever really in doubt. I thought there was some really interesting dialogue, you know, and I was trying to explain this to one of my daughters the other day, that the thing that I like about sci-fi is you can play around with these fantastical universes. Slight plug there for Steve's website. These fantastic universes, but you're grounding the issues of real life here on Terran or Earth, you know, and they're talking. There's really this kind of classist snooty way that the Shi'ar see themselves. I mean, they are a colonial empire, aren't they? And so, you know, they're talking about him and his ghetto on the wrong side of the tracks, pretty much. Is it the wrong side of the stars, and it's a ghetto of the Milky Way or something like that?
Yeah.
There's some real, you know, you know, this he's very much looked down on as a Terran. And so, you know, you'll be infecting the kind of bloodline kind of thing. So I thought it was, even though I don't love the Shi'ar stuff, just as a rule, I thought that the dialogue was brilliant in this episode there.
It is, yeah. There's like a Shakespearean quality, because Charles's turn of phrase is very old-fashioned and almost Shakespearean as well. So the dialogue was really sort of heightened, and you can't help but get into it. But then we see, obviously, Charles is literally on the verge of having his, you know, Lilandra's going to do it for him because she has similar psychic gifts as Charles, and she's literally about to, obviously, you know, wipe the slate, so to speak. And then there's this sort of battle between the Deathbird and her crew, and then the Royal Guard as well. And it, all of a sudden, he sort of has this epiphany, doesn't he, where he's like, I've been neglecting my great gifts. There's a line like that. I can't remember exactly what he says. It's something like that. And
my
then he
greatest
literally,
gift.
My greatest gift, that's it. And he literally then snaps back into the old Charles. And in a very weird scene, I get the concept because it's like he's going back to embracing his old life as a mentor and a teacher. Mm. But it's a little bit of a goofy scenario, isn't it? Where he literally psychically puts all the top-ranking Shi'ar into like a virtual classroom situation behind tables and desks. And he's there at the front of the sort of mock classroom chewing on an apple. And trying to teach them about coexistence. I mean, I fully get the concept because that's, like I said before, that's Charles's whole mantra in life is about coexistence and, you know, learning off each other and harmony and all this. But I found the actual scene a little bit cringe just to watch him like that, you know, as this sort of weird classroom scenario. What did you make of it, Dave?
Yeah, I thought it was a little cringy as well. And I thought the first time I watched it, I thought his greatest power is, you know, basically intruding on people's minds and paralyzing them while he pokes around in their brains kind of thing. But I actually think on the second watch, I think it's more about him being a teacher, isn't it? Him teaching people a lesson and teaching, you know, the why colonialism is not bad, because you kind of, you don't give people a choice. They basically have to conform. They're like the Borg almost, aren't they? You know, basically introduce other cultures into the Shi'ar Empire, but they have to conform to how, you know, the Shi'ar operate kind of thing. So again, I felt like it was quite clever in some of the messaging there. But yeah, I don't, you know, and giving out demerits, you know, I think Cyclops Scott Summers was saying about, you know, he was reminiscing about, you know, missing Xavier, and he was talking about getting demerit points and stuff. So I thought that was an interesting little callback there. But yeah, I don't know how they could have done it better, but I feel like the cringe is almost worth it for the scene that happens later. So when it all starts to go to shit and he starts to see what's kind of happened in episode 5, and then all of the people, all of the classroom are suddenly skeletons. And I think that makes it the earlier cringe kind of worth it for me.
Yeah, it is quite a striking moment, isn't it? Where he gets this sort of psychic vision of Gambit's death. You don't see his actual death, but you see him as like this sort of decaying giant skeleton, don't you? Which is quite an interesting.
He becomes like Master Mold, doesn't he?
Yeah. There's an element to that, and I suppose, you know, his death was at the hands of Master Mold, so I guess there's a tie in there. So I guess it's Charles piecing it together, and it's quite. His change is like instant, isn't it? He's like, right, I have to go back to Earth right now, and even says to Lilandra, if this means with me going back to Earth means the end of our relationship, then so be it. Literally 10 minutes before, he was like, oh, I love you so much, I'm going to wipe my memories of my past life because it's all about me and you, baby. And then he's literally like, I'm going back to Earth now, and if that means me and you are finished, so be it, love.
Fucking right off.
It is, but then I suppose it works because it's that sacrifice, isn't it? This was his, like you said before, this was his one chance at almost a true bliss, wasn't it? You know, to be with the woman he loves in this, you know, new life away from the horrors of Earth or Terran, and just, you know, be with her and, you know, hopefully try and, like she says to him, she even says to him, with you by my side, we can try and have a more peaceful existence. She says to him, you know, help me teach them, you know, to be more, and, you know, he could have made a big difference alongside her. And he's literally saying, right, well, I've got to go, you know, they need me. And this life's not for me, I guess. So it's a bit of a poor Lilandra, I suppose. She's done nothing wrong, but she's been, she saved his life. B, she fell in love with him and off, you know, gave him a wonderful, what seems like a fantastic relationship, especially in the boudoir. And I was going to say something else, but I checked myself at the last minute. And thirdly, it's like, you know, she's, as well as offering him, as well as giving him life, giving him love, she's also giving him status and power alongside her at the head of the table. So I feel really sorry for Lilandra, actually. She's a really good person, isn't she? And she's essentially getting dumped, isn't she? Yeah, she is. She is.
And you kind of wonder, I mean, the thing I look at Xavier's role in this as well is he's kind of like your own role as a parent in that, you know, you've got your kids, but at some point they'll fly the nest, won't they? They'll go off and do their own thing, and you always want to make sure they've got that kind of safe space for you to come back to. But, you know, if they'll bugger off to different countries or something, I've wondered this myself. I'm like, what would I do? I mean, I'm not going to agonize too much about it, but, you know, if everyone buggers off, it's like, oh, maybe I'll just go and live in Hawaii for a bit. You know, if you kind of, you know, you're freed from the shackles of being in that one place. And I guess the difference is, you know, Xavier kind of almost sees himself as that father figure or this iteration of him. And so I think, I can kind of believe it that, you know, in that moment where it's like, oh, you know, the X-Men, they seem to be doing fine. And, you know, I'm in love with this Lilandra space alien. You know, I'm going to do my Captain Kirk sort of thing and just get down to it. You know, so he's like 52%, you know, I'll stay here and wipe my memory because once my memory's wiped, it's fine. I'm in the Matrix then. So, you know, all is good. But 48% is probably, I should really go back. But when he knows that they're in trouble, that's it. The pendulum swung the other way. So like you say, Lilandra has ended up being the injured party, really. She hasn't done anything wrong. But I can kind of go with Charles's motivation there.
Yeah, I understand. Yeah, I don't think like it's like, how dare you, Charles, because you understand he has to do it. But you just, I don't know. I really felt sorry for the poor cow, to be honest with you. You know, it's not to say they can't, you know, find a way forward, you know, once the dust has settled. But I think once he's back, I don't think this series will be one where, you know, the situation on Earth plays out however it plays out. And if some kind of resolution is reached where a new status quo is established and things are okay, I don't think he's then going to go, my work here is done, I'm back off to with the love of my life, Lilandra. I think that relationship's pretty much doomed now, isn't it?
I mean, if you were Lilandra, you wouldn't take him back. And I don't know if the cow reference was intended, but wasn't it... didn't Reed Richards turn the Skrulls into cows or something way back?
Something like that. Yeah,
it was something like that, wasn't it?
Yeah,
with another Skrull. Because obviously, I do think even with this episode, I do feel like it is going to play into the MCU in some way. I'm fine for it being its own thing, but especially there were a couple of things in the, well, not a couple of things. There was one thing in particular when we get onto the Forge and Storm story that made me think, oh, that is very consistent with the MCU.
Well, that's where we're going now, because we're going to jump over to that. So for people who can remember episode four, it ended, Storm's gone, she's lost her power, so she's gone to stay with Forge. As he said to her, I believe I've got a method that we can restore your powers, which as of the end of that episode, it hadn't yet been successful. They'd had a falling out because, he'd sort of confessed to her that the weaponry that cost her powers was basically built on the back of his original design, even though he hadn't sort of explicitly been a party to what it eventually became. It was still his initial blueprints, his initial technology that was built upon. But obviously before she taken a leave of him, they were attacked by the adversary, this demonic character that took a big bite out of Forge. And that's where we pick up, where we meet them again. He's got a heavily infected shoulder. She's kind of nursing him, and he's in a pretty dire situation near death. And they're like, what can we do here? And he says, there is a rare cactus that we can use on this, and that will sort of cure me of the poison of the adversary's bite, but we've got to go to this cave and get it. And then obviously the adventure kicks on from there. But go on, tell us, what about that specific scenario do you think was sort of MCU centric then?
So obviously when we get into the story, we've spent a bit of time with the Shi'ar and stuff, but we get back down onto Earth, and we can see Storm. She's nursing Forge, and he looks in a pretty bad way, doesn't he?
He's fucked.
he is absolutely fucked. One interesting thing as well, I'm sure with Forge, he's one of these characters that's used sort of sparingly, but I remember his kind of cybernetic leg be sort of starting just above the knee, whereas here it seems to go right up to his arse kind of thing. I just makes me wonder where he stops and the cybernetics start. But he looks like you say basically fucked, and the adversary is like just giving a shit constantly, like let him die, it's fine, no one will know. He's not done anything. He's basically stripped you of your powers kind of thing. It was when, she gets, to tussling with the adversary, and then out of nowhere, Forge suddenly can wield magic. Like he's Doctor Strange or something. So he's holding the book. And it was very much like what we've seen in Doctor Strange and Shang-Chi, the way in the MCU you get that yellow kind of energy signature. So that was the thing that made me go, right, okay, they are being consistent there. So we had the Terran stuff. Again, it obviously comes from the comics, but in the original series, they weren't that married to, little things like that. Whereas, here, that was the thing that made me think, I wonder if they're going to tie it in some way.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah. You're spot on in what you're saying. It literally looks like the power of the Sorcerer Supreme, doesn't it? Whether there's any, he does mention it's, he says like it's my mother's old book of spells or something like this, isn't it? My mother's book of shaman desert. I think he calls it desert magic actually at one point, which is like, the character Forge has like he's able to tap into, although his mutant power is essentially the gift to be able to invent anything he can conceive.
Yep.
He has these sort of shamanistic powers, I think is the right word. I guess they're tapping into that. But yeah, the graphic, the imagery is exactly the same, isn't it? It reminds me of that scene when they all come out of the portals at the end of Avengers Endgame there for the big battle, and Strange says to Wong, is that everyone? And Wong goes, what, you wanted more? And they all sort of do that thing, don't they, the sorcerers, and the things appear around the hands. It very much looks like that, doesn't it? It's I like that sort of uniformity as well. It kind of it reminds you that everything's connected. So
and what I I'm glad you made that point, because I feel like when that came up, it felt like you remember that excitement with the earlier days in the MCU where you're like, oh, that does connect to this other thing. And it feels organic. It feels like it's there to be consistent. Whereas in the last few years, it's like, oh, God, you just like Secret Invasion. Are you, all you're doing is you're showing us this story to spin off three other stories. Like, you know, you're really forcing it in there. Whereas this didn't feel forced. Like you say, it just feels consistent. And it feels like for the real fans, you know, spot this shit. You know, that's for us.
Yeah. Definitely. It's I like little Easter eggs and little bits and pieces like that are scattered in, and just makes you go, oh, you know, that famous sort of meme picture doing the rounds of Leonardo DiCaprio. I think it's from Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
Yeah, yeah.
He's like that, pointing at the screen. Like, oh, what's this? Yeah, I like stuff like that. It's like a little treat for fans and what have you. So, you know, I mean, they are going to do an X-Men live action film in the MCU. It's, you know, it's as plain as day. I think once we've had Deadpool and Wolverine this summer, maybe the path to that will become a little bit clearer with regards how that film ends and who may or may not cameo in that film. There's a lot of speculation about that. And then obviously we do have Avengers Secret Wars to come, which is very much going to be a multiversal extravaganza, isn't it? Where you can bring in all other iterations of characters that we've already seen in, you know, the Fox universe and what have you. So I'm very intrigued to see how they do bring the X-Men in, and what the take on it is, especially with a very much established MCU now for a number of years, which by then will almost be 20 years in. How they bring in mutant kind, and, you know, what the explanation for that is, and, you know, how the anti-mutant sentiment will sort of exist in the MCU, because in the MCU, there's, you know, everyone's knows about individuals with superpowers. So where would that anti-mutant sentiment come from in the MCU when there's no anti-superpower sentiment, and there's not even barring a handful of characters, no one even has a secret identity in the MCU either. Everyone knows who
just
they are.
Spider-Man, isn't it?
Yeah, just Spider-Man,
and Daredevil, I guess.
Yeah, Spider-Man, Daredevil, because they've got quote unquote regular lives that they need to protect, whereas everyone else is sort of, you know, either a public figure or, you know, not living in a real regular world situation. So no one wears a mask or anything like that. So I'd be very intrigued to see how they do it. I mean, the wheels will already be in motion, but how they do it is anybody's guess, really, isn't it?
So I'm going to chuck a bit of a Hail Mary here. I mean, I do, you know, do feel like a lot of people have dropped off the MCU, and even me, I didn't think I could ever get bored. It's like imagining that you could get bored of chocolate or something like that. But, you know, I'm at the point where it's like, oh, yeah, there's some stuff, and it's just been a bit substandard, and I don't feel like I have to watch everything. Still not watched Echo, to be honest. I need to remedy that. But, you know, before I'd have been all over it. Whereas what I think they're going to do, they have been bloating things out. And like I say, there have been company reasons for them to do that, to get subscribers on there. But I've got a feeling that when you get Secret Wars, you're going to get the whole Battle World thing going on. You know, the way they're going to try and knit it together, I don't think everything will become clear after Deadpool 3. I think it will just be more threads leading on to other things. But Secret Wars, I think, or maybe it won't happen in the first one, but maybe after that, it's going to be a bloodbath. You're going to have this multiversal chaos, and lots of people are going to get killed off. I think they've, you know, in each, if you think about it, like WandaVision, you know, sprouting out of that, you had Ms. Marvel, or Captain Marvel, rather, coming out of that. Not the Carol Danvers Captain Marvel, but you also had White Vision as well. Mm-hmm. He's off doing something. So even each series has sprung out all these side characters as well.
Yeah.
I think they're going to have to kill off a lot. And they're going to use the Secret Wars stuff as a bit of a reboot. because it kind of has to be. No one's ever done this. No one's ever got. You know, I always use the X-Men as an example. Like that original trilogy, they couldn't even fucking keep three movies consistent. In the third one, you got like Emma Frost showing up randomly, and it's like, oh, this is bollocks, you know. And so, for me to do what they've done is amazing, but you kind of have to reboot it. You know, like you say, if you're 20 years old, like I made my kids watch all of the MCU movies. So by the time Endgame came out, they knew everything that was what to expect. But people drop out and they're like, oh, fuck this. I'm not going to watch like 20, 30 movies and like a whole bunch of series to find out what's going on. So I'm out. They're going to have to remedy that some way. So I think it's going to be, you know, almost like a crisis type reboot, I think.
Post-Secret Wars. I think they're going to have to do a soft reboot of some kind, yeah, because, you know, actors are aging out as well. You know, actors that have been there since the start are now in the 50s. And if you want to keep the universe going, you're going to have to refresh it somehow. So, yeah, I think you're right. We might see characters that have been killed off maybe reintroduced, but with a different actor playing it because it's, and you know, the multiverse is combined into one or something like this. So I'm intrigued. It's going to be an interesting few years, that's for sure. My God. It's, you know, they've not put many feet wrong, although, like you said, the last few years have been a bit lackluster, but far from shit. So it'll be interesting to see how it all comes together. But before we finish, we'll finish off this episode real quick. So we get back to, obviously, Storm and Forge, and they're going to this cactus. And again, there's a great callback to the original series where we see Storm. She has to go through a very to go and retrieve this cactus. She has to crawl through this. They go into like a cave, but there's like it's like an old mine from the Civil War or something. There's munitions in there, but she's got to crawl through this entirely closed off, confined space. And it harkens back to previous episodes where we see she has this acute. I guess you call it claustrophobia. Anyway, this massive fear of being locked in, and she has to overcome it. Which and essentially, this the key to having her powers back is overcoming fear, isn't it? It's not so much anything technological or anything that you know, some dazzling machine that Forge invents. The whole key to her sort of getting her powers back is throwing away fear, embracing who she is, and overcoming any obstacles. And it's wonderfully symbolic as well, isn't it? How when she, you know, she does tap into it, she becomes an entirely new person. She doesn't look like the old Storm. It's a new costume as well, isn't it? Yeah. That like the 90s Jim Lee blackout ensemble, as opposed to, you know, what she wore throughout the entire original series and start of this. It's a really cool, epic moment, isn't it? Where she, you know, does this monologue and finally everything comes together and the mountain shakes with wind. It's epic, isn't it? It's an epic moment. In a weird way, it kind of reminds me of, it's a bit of a weird comparison, but it reminds me of the film Man of Steel, when he first learns his true heritage and puts on the suit for the first time. And you hear that monologue over the top from Russell Crowe about, you know, pushing yourself, testing your limits, you know, you can accomplish anything. What great wonders if you, you know, tap into what you can do, and then you finally like flies properly for the first time. It just reminded me of that, the groundswell of the music as well. Wonderful, wonderful sequence, wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I always think for the music, so if we're making a Superman parallel, I'd almost think to Superman 2, where you think Superman has been stripped of his powers, but actually he played a trick, and Zod and his cronies have had their powers taken away, and you get him crushing Zod's hand, and then the music you hear, and he lifts Zod up, and you know, it just honestly, when we're reminiscing about the Storm, you know, basically getting her powers back or freeing herself of those mental shackles, because I think that's really what it was. But I was just getting goosebumps on my arms there. It's just, it's such a great moment. And I actually think, I mean, the adversary, kind of did a good job there, because it was basically the adversary being a bit of an arsehole and like sledging Storm that gets her all pissed off, and she's like, fuck this shit, you know, and that's what kind of frees herself of those mental shackles and, you know, gets her powers back. But I actually think Forge's machine did work.
Right.
You know, that was in the first part, wasn't it?
Yeah.
You know, she went into the machine and it's like, oh, but Forge is this genius inventor kind of thing. It's a bit weird that it didn't work. And I think the adversary just, you know, talking about the things that she shut off from her mind and stuff, I think a combination of all those things were what led her back. And I talked about that classic X-Men number one. Well, if you look at that, that's the costume Storm's got. You know, top left,
yes.
And she's in that kind of black costume, and she looks fucking badass, doesn't she? So, and it's such a great rebirth, and you know, they obviously know what's happened again in Remember It, episode 5, and you know, she's going to come and she's going to take some names. So, even though I really, really enjoyed that, I think I still feel like we could have gone another, you know, we could have gone through the whole season and she's part of the X-Men, but she doesn't have her powers. She's got, and again, when I think of the character, I think of the way Claremont sort of wrote her, but she's such a great leader.
Yeah.
You know, there's so many great things about the Storm character that aren't just her powers. So it's just a little nitpick of mine that I'd quite like to see that explored a little bit more. I thought that could have created some interesting stories. But yeah, I'm still going to enjoy it when she's got her powers. And like I said, she's going to take some names.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, the music is the same. I can't confess to being that switched on that I noticed it. But I was reading a bit today. And if you remember the first episode of this new series, when they take down the Sentinels and Cyclops comes out with that line about, give me the weather forecast or something. And then she comes in and the Sentinel goes, Omega level threat detected. And she comes in. It's the same music that plays then
as
played in this episode when she, you know, embraces her powers and destroys the adversary and becomes, you know, arguably even more powerful than before with the new costume and looking great. It's the same music. So it's a nice little callback that. Like you said, it would have been very interesting actually to keep her depowered for a bit, just for what you can do with it and, you know, sort of having to provide worth without having those magical, you know, those wondrous powers and still being a valuable member of the team. I would have quite liked to see that dynamic and what she felt she could bring to the table and how the rest of the team would treat her and that. But at the same time, it is great to see her, you know, fully kitted out again. And you know, it's an enticing prospect we're faced with now with Charles on his way back to Earth, Storm, you know, fully energized again and ready to rejoin the team. What they're going to do next, you know, they're obviously not going to retaliate because that's not necessarily what the X-Men are about, but how they're going to, you know, move forward and who they're going to confront. I mean, we do get that little stinger at the end. What's been great about this new series is every episode has ended with something really it's almost like a post-credit scene, but in front of the credits, isn't it? Like a really great scene that whets your appetite, where you think, oh, shit, I can't wait for next week. And here's no exception. We learn who was the mastermind behind the Sentinel attack. There was a lot of speculation about who it might be. Would it be, you know, would they somehow have brought Cassandra Nova in, Xavier's sister, who was behind it in the E for Extinction book? That whole sequence was kind of based on loosely, but no, she's nowhere to be seen. So we learn, obviously, again, spoiler alert, everyone, it is Mr. Sinister, who obviously it's a welcome return for him. We haven't seen him since the whole Madeline Pryor clone scenario in episode 2, I think it was. So we learn he's behind it all. So it's enticing, isn't it? You know, what his motivation is for this and what, you know, what the confrontation's going to be, what his end game is. It's very intriguing stuff, isn't it?
It is, and you know, I say about how much I love the X-Men and stuff, but some of the things are ridiculous, aren't they? You know, the fact that you got this guy, Mr. Sinister. What if his name was Sinister, but he just turned out to be a really nice guy, you know? Also, like one of the X-Factor characters, Peter David's X-Factor run, I absolutely love as well. Mm. I didn't mention that before. The second volume in particular really goes into the interaction between all the characters, and one of those characters is called Richter, and you know he has earthquake powers. it's just some of the names are a bit on the nose, but yeah. Yeah, I do like. It's an interesting point. If they'd have made it, you know, an after credits scene, you know, would people have groaned? They're like, oh god, it's MCU stuff. But yeah, like you say, it is like an after credits scene, isn't it? So I like the fact you've got that, you know, that ongoing story almost. And I feel like it was an interesting kind of break from last week. I guess I had the perception that, you know, from what had been discussed by the creators and stuff, that after episode 5, everything's going to get a bit darker now. Mm-hmm. Everything's a bit, you know, it's not all, we're going to battle Sentinels, no one's going to get killed or anything. Things are going to be a bit grim. Whereas this felt, you know, it was more consistent with the previous season that we'd seen, or previous episodes that we'd seen.
Definitely. Yeah, there's a real sense of stakes, isn't there? That we were saying before, it's the balls of the show to kill off major characters, or seemingly kill off. You know, it's comic book material. No one stays dead in comics. But yeah, I like that. And like you said, it gives it a real. There's a real tangible sense of danger in this show. You know, a lot of times when you watch stuff, especially animated stuff, it's hard to feel that sense of danger, isn't it? Because you think, well, you know. They're not going to kill off the major players, you know. It's they as well as this being aimed at adults, you know, you want children to be able to watch it as well. So it's never going to get too dark. But they've really gone that way with this show. I think it's a lot. The original series was dark, but I think this has taken it up a notch. This has taken that darkness to the nth degree a little bit more. It's certainly. You know, there's certain elements of this show, you know, my son Oliver's 9, and there's certain bits of the last week or two where I think, I'm not so sure I'd want him to watch that. So I like it. They've really, they're not dumbing it down, are they? They're not being afraid to show certain things.
Yeah, even when Ronan the Accuser gets stamped on by Deathbird, you do see he gets a bit of blood, doesn't he? And just going back to last week, I actually thought some of the scenes were quite manga like, quite manga slash anime like. You guys commented on it that when Gambit, I shouldn't laugh, you know, the guy's about to get killed, but you know, while he's driving towards Master Mold on his bike there, he's fucking miles away, and just takes a leap, and then suddenly he gets skewered.
Yeah,
and the way he's kind of held up there, it felt like anime to me, just the way that was all shot. And so I'd not really seen that in this series before.
Yeah, no, it's really good. I mean, I thought it'd be good, this new series. Well, I had high hopes, but they were hopes. You know, they weren't expectations; they were hopes. And I think it's surpassed them with more to spare. I think it's the way they've just depicted the characters, the way it's written, the way it's, you know, the script, the voice acting, the actual scenarios that play out as well, you know, the deaths, you know, the some of the stuff's quite hard hitting. I think it's the best thing that Marvel have done in years. In terms of, you know, visual, I don't mean comics. I mean the visual medium, the TV or film world. I think it's the best thing that they've done in years. And I think the almost, I said it before on this show, the almost universal approval from the fan base, I think is testament to that, isn't it? I don't think I've seen any, you know, with anything that comes out, there'll always be someone who doesn't like it. And that's fair enough. It's art. It's all subjective. You know, your opinion's your own. But I haven't seen one dissenting voice about this show. I don't know if you have, but there hasn't been one, has there, basically? Everyone, almost to a T, has said, yeah, we love it.
Yeah, and I think, you know, it seems like they couldn't drop the ball, you know, just update the animation a little bit and keep consistent with what was there before, and it'll be sweet. But we've seen with so many other things that there's lots of different ways that you can fuck it up, and only a few ways that you can sort of people please. But no, they've definitely done that. They've given us something that, you know, feels familiar, but definitely something that's new as well. And I definitely think, you know, post Endgame, I'd probably say it's the best thing they've done. I mean, I've said I'm wobbling a bit on the MCU. I quite liked, you know, seeing all the different Spider-Men was an amazing moment. You know, I still think back to being in the cinema. It's like, holy shit, you know, as this thing was unfolding. I thought Doctor Strange 2 was good as well. Mm. You know, so they have released some decent stuff, but this is a different level. Mm. And definitely. I think not just the animation, you know, bringing back some of the familiar voice actors was great as well. I just think the writing is so good. It's consistent with the original series. But again, I think it has stepped up a little bit, you know, and the little tie-ins, like, say, you know, referring to people as from Earth as Terrans. I think, you know, the stuff we've talked about with Forge having the magic that's consistent with what we've seen in the MCU before. I think all of that stuff is really well done.
Yeah. Oh, I do. I think it's just they've just knocked it out of the park. They really have. I think they've managed to keep that consistency with the original series, but just brought it a little bit more contemporary, but without making it two on the nose. They've just, you know, they've kept that tone, they've kept that style. Obviously keeping as many of the original voices as well helps as well for the ones who were still, you know, alive and able to do it, and, you know, others who weren't have taken other roles in the series to more suit their, you know, older voices and what have you. But I just think even the one new ones have come in have managed to sound very much like the original voice actor as well. You know, I meant to mention it during this discussion, but the guy who plays Xavier now, Ross Marquand, he sounds fantastic. He really does sound very much like the original voice of Xavier from the 90s. I think he does a great impression of him. It's really good overall. But just brilliant stuff. Now, before we leave you, before Dave and I wrap up, I did say at the top of the show that despite Dan not being present to contribute this week, he is contributing because he's recorded his own sort of thoughts and feelings about this episode all the way from sunny Mallorca. And he's, by the gift of technology, whisked those thoughts over to us. So what we're going to do real quick now before me and Dave say goodbye to you is we're just going to play you Dan's thoughts. He's recorded this so you can enjoy it. Take it away, Dan.
Hello, this is your ever uncanny, ever astonishing co-host for Examining X-Men 97. It is Spider Dan here, coming to you live. Not so live, but from sunny Mallorca. Again, sorry I couldn't be there, guys, but this getaway is exactly what I needed. But I thought I'd send my feelings on the latest episode, Life Death Part 2, right over to you. Again, I think this is a nice palate cleanse from the previous frankly traumatic episode. So again, it's a little bit of something different. It's not quite what I expected, but we'll get into that. But it is entitled Life Death Part 2, so it has a portion of it focusing on Forge and the adversary and this demon that feeds on anger, self-loathing, fear, hatred, all those kind of horrible things, preying on not only Forge, but not only Storm as well. But also we get a glimpse of the Shi'ar Empire, which we talked about a lot at the start of this podcast series. We talked about Xavier not technically being dead, even though the X-Men are feeling that way. They're making the assumption that he is dead, but as we see in this episode, he's alive and kicking, and hand, kicking quite literally, as he's got this armored suit that allows him to walk around, which is from the earlier Jim Lee, kind of when his return was made. He was in a silver version of that outfit, and the big reveal was when they took off his mask and it was Xavier, much like in this episode. But he was, it wasn't the armor that was able to walk. He was healed, his legs were healed so he could walk. So we have that, and we have the kind of ongoing kind of drama, the kind of Game of Thrones style kind of political drama going on there as well. I want to talk about the intro very, very briefly, because we have two characters that are no longer in the intro, but we do have the addition of one important one, which tells us he definitely did survive the previous attack, the previous episode. Nightcrawler seems to be have been added to the lineup of X-Men. So it looks like he's going to officially join the team in some capacity, which I'm very happy about. Again, I talked about how much I love that character. And again, we said he lit up the screen, me and Max said last week. So I'm glad he's a proper addition to the team. I think a very welcome one, especially. But yes, we have that. And again, Magneto and Gambit are no longer in the intro, which says a lot. But also there was a shot of Nimrod, which is the future Sentinel from the Days of Future Past storyline, inside a master mold, which is again linked back to another character we talked about in a previous episode. But if you want to listen in and go back to those episodes, listen then. But I think again, this episode probably isn't my favorite out of the ones we've had. Again, I think it's more, I'd say it's not quite as low on the list as Motendo or Life Death Part One, but it's not too far above it. But I still, again, had a very good time. The Shi'ar are at war with Kree, which happened in the comics in Avengers Galactic Storm, which is a huge kind of crossover with all the Avengers titles at the time in the early 90s, which I highly recommend. It's a great blast and leads to a schism or a fracturing of that team into the West Coast, and the West Coast Avengers basically become no more, and they become Force Works, which are led by Iron Man, and Captain America leads the regular Avengers. But yeah, it was really interesting to see Charles walking around. We got a new voice, which I believe is Marquand, who, again, we talked about was in Infinity War and he's from The Walking Dead. I think he does a serviceable job. I don't think it's quite the same. And I think he's trying something a bit different. I don't think he's trying to imitate the person that we're, the actor that previously played the role, but there's still enough of that flavor there where you can go, yeah, it kind of still feels the same. I'm not sure if the Landra is still the same voice actress. I don't believe it is, but I'm glad. I thought she did an amazing job in that role, and I love the kind of star-crossed lovers element to it. You know, they're two people from two very different worlds, but they have this psychic rapport, this connection, and again, she's regal in this royalty, and she has her duty to her people, and Xavier has his duty to his X-Men, and you see that come into play, and Deathbird comes in, who I think is a really cool character, really cool design. Again, I discovered her during that same issue that they brought back Xavier. She may have been introduced in that issue, I'm not sure. No, she was introduced in Ms. Marvel, actually. But anyway, so she comes into it and she's leading an attack on Ronan the Accuser, as we'll all know, is in Guardians of the Galaxy. That character turns up and again has a lot of, you know, in War of the Kings, Realm of the Kings, and all the kind of Annihilation storylines, he plays a big factor in those storylines as well, if you've read those. And they've also announced Annihilation 2099 is going to happen in the comics at the moment. But yeah, really, really interesting introduction. But I love the idea that he's being forced to have his memory wiped. And again, it rings true back to the Dark Phoenix saga again, where, you know, Xavier reads Alandra's mind and says, then we're going to have this battle to decide whether Jean lives or dies. And yeah, wonderful, wonderful kind of callbacks to that, and Gladiator. And I love that there's still this bigotry in a Shi'ar Empire that's made up of so many different races from so many different planets. They consider Earth a backwater planet. They use the term that not only is Xavier a Terran, so he's human, but he's also from a lower caste, which I was like, ooh, like the term half caste is obviously quite problematic, as it means half pure, which is something we don't use anymore because of that that terminology and that phrasing, but again, it's more mixed race, I believe, at the moment at this time. But I thought that was really interesting that even galaxies away in seemingly, very equal kind of empire, that there's still that bigotry there, like deep down, even miles away from Earth, light years away from Earth, there's still bigotry to be found. So that was really interesting. And I love that Xavier took them to school and he put them in the classroom and gave them demerits and the apples and uses the astral plane. And then that leads into the episode that we have, leads into the kind of realization that he needs to go back. And if he needs to give up Lalandra and this wonderful rich life he now has as a king, but that just goes to show how much he believes in his X-Men, his children. Again, he describes them as children of the Atom, which was often how they were described in the name of one of the video games that a lot of the voice actors would apply their voices to. Really, really interesting. And the life-death storyline is good. I love that Storm's issue is more of a mental block, less of a... the power was always there, but it was just a kind of a jolt by the energy weapon to take it away. But she just needs to find her voice and find who she was and rediscover exactly who she was. And they give her a classic kind of Storm outfit, which I loved as well. And hair grows back partially as well. Really interesting. And I love that they kind of harken back to her life. And also they're talking about America's history with indigenous people as well. And they were challenging that. I love that Forge's sorcery kind of comes into play, which I mentioned in the previous podcast. And again, it's very much in the same way that Doctor Strange sorcery works, the kind of glyphs and runes and things that go around his arms. Wonderful. Really, really nice, a really good kind of character. Again, maybe is it going a bit too fast again? It could be argued maybe she shouldn't have got her powers back just yet, because she kind of just acknowledges that she's probably better without them, but then she gets them back anyway, because that's her, she overcomes her fears, her mental block, it's much like Barry Allen and his mental block, Wally West and his mental block not being as good as Barry Allen in those DC comic books. So yeah, really good. But at the end we learn that Bolivar Trask's DNA was used to activate the Sentinel. I believe they call it a Master Mold Sentinel, not a Wild Sentinel, what have you. But we learn that it's Mr. Sinister, seemingly, behind the attack on Genosha. But why? For what reason would he want to kill all of those mutants? And again, he was the leader behind, or the instigator behind, the mutant massacre in the comics in the 80s. That was his thing. So who knows where that will lead. But again, a lot of twists and turns, things I can't predict. But I'm really enjoying the show. Again, maybe a lesser episode for some. It's quite a talky episode, I believe, this one. Less kind of action-packed. But after the last episode, again, I think you need a palate cleanse. So I think this is a fine kind of addition to the story. And I'm glad to see that we're getting Xavier back in some fashion, whatever that may be. I'm looking to see what the fallout is from the Genosha attack. Wonderful, wonderful stuff. I've probably gone on way too long, as I usually do. I am known for prattling on. I've really, really enjoyed this episode and really had a lot of fun, and I can't wait for the next one and to see what that brings. I believe that's Bright Eyes next, which I'm guessing is some kind of Cyclops, fueled episode, maybe. Who knows? I could be completely wrong again. I didn't see Sinister being the one to lead the attack, but it makes sense given that the Morlocks died, and again, linking into that comic. But yeah, I absolutely love this one. Again, really, really good. Not as good as maybe some of the others. Definitely not as bad as Matendo, but even Matendo I didn't find terrible. I'm just hoping the quality keeps on coming and while I'm away. But thank you again, Max and Dave. I'm looking forward to listening. I'm sure you'll do an excellent job, but I'll leave it there. But thank you very much again for having me, and hopefully I'll send my thoughts next time as well. Bye.
And there you have it. That was great stuff from Dan, as always. Thank you, Dan. And he's going to do the same again next week, because as I said at the top of the show, excuse me, next week's episode, Dan obviously will still be sunning himself in Mallorca. So Dave and I will be back next week to contribute again for your delectation with episode 7, the interestingly titled Bright Eyes. Now, whether that's, a tribute to the Art Garfunkel Watership Down classic ditty.
My God.
Who can say?
So, Sorry, I'm going to cut across you there. You know, talk about fucking traumatic childhood memories. I have never gone back to watch Watership Down because I just remember blubbering, you know, like a baby. And at some point, I know I've got to go back and watch it. But, you know, I talked about the Red Wedding. We had episode 5, remember it. But Watership Down, that is equally fucking traumatic.
I'll say. I remember that as a kid, and I won't go back and watch it because that is nightmare fuel.
Yeah, see, it makes me worried for next week now that I think about it.
Exactly. You know, I mean, Bright Eyes, could it be something to do with Cyclops? You know, is it going to be Cyclops-oriented episode? Something, you know, because he's very much in the doldrums at the moment in the course of the plot with what he's just been through with his wife not really being his wife and his literal newborn son having to be whisked off into the future and obviously so, what's happened in Genosha. So
can we maybe speculate a bit because I don't want to go too far ahead of myself because I feel like Magneto, I mean, an amazing moment where, you know, you think he's kind of killed off, you know, and he says to Leech, doesn't he, you know, don't be afraid, but he says it in his native tongue. Amazing, touching moment. And I tell you what, one of the lines of the series is, and I'm going to butcher it because I probably can't remember it exactly, but it's something like, you know, let us not live out our days wondering if we could have saved more. You know, what an amazing line, and just, it's just, again, it gets you, you know, riled up, you know, go on, Magneto. But I do feel like he's going to come back and he's going to be pissed. And he's going to blame possibly the humans, you know, for allowing this thing to happen. And so that's what's going to, he's not just going to turn into a mustache twirling villain. And that's what I love about Magneto is, you know, you can get it. You know, if that was you, you'd be fucking pissed off as well. You know, don't give me the Shaolin monk stuff. Back in, I want some vengeance. So I feel like that's what we're going to get. It's interesting that kind of Scott Summers, you know, he's kind of been the leader, hasn't he? And again, episode 1, absolute kick-ass. But you've got Storm, who's also a leader. We saw last week, Callisto was one of the bodies. She's dead now.
Yep.
So does Storm take a place as leader of the Morlocks again? You know, but I feel like there's going to be this interesting sort of power struggle. And with Scott, he was getting a bit tetchy, wasn't he, with the reporter, old Beast Mrs. And you know, he was getting a bit pissed off with them. I kind of feel like it'd be really interesting to see Scott rebel a bit against Xavier and maybe fall a little bit more on the Magneto side. Like, you know, he does kind of go down that route in the comics, doesn't he? So that's what I'm hoping for. It might not happen in this season, but maybe a season 2 thing.
Yeah, that's what I want to say. I think we touched on that a week or two ago, and I'd love to see that. I want to see Scott become that Cyclops from Avengers versus X-Men, that militant, you know, not villainous, but yet militant and sort of so driven. Where
strategist,
where he's willing to go to extreme lengths to get what he wants, you know, whilst not being a villainous character, he's still like on the edge, and his methods become somewhat questionable, and then you know the other, you know, certain X-Men will follow him, certain X-Men will go, no, you can't act like this, and then oppose him, and that would, I think that would be a really interesting thing to explore, whether, like you said, whether it's in this season or whether it's, you know, further down the line. We are going to get plenty of further down the line from what they're saying. So yeah, I'd love to see that. It would really just give so much more enrichment to the character, and you know, you can see, like you said, you can see that little germ of it, can't you? Just sort of starting there with his demeanor and his attitude towards Jean now, and you know, the sort of shitty hand he's been dealt, you know, which, you know, you can understand it. You can understand it in a way. If you find out your wife's not really your wife, and then the kid you've had together has to be whisked away to the future because otherwise he'll die, and you sort of resign to never seeing him again. That's enough to tip any man sort of, you know, towards the dark side, for as someone once said. So yeah, interesting.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's much more drawn out in the comics, but I felt the way Scott just went back to original Jean. It was like, okay, Madeline, turns out you're a clone. Off you fuck then. It's like, but none of them know, and they've intentionally done this, haven't they? So you don't know, was it Jean who actually committed genocide when she was possessed by the Phoenix? So yeah. That's why they're making it like, oh, you know, when was she really swapped in and out with clone Jean or Madeline Pryor? Yeah. But it seemed to me, I was thinking, well, if this was real life, wouldn't you be more inclined to stay with Madeline? You know, you've been sleeping with her for years. Mm-hmm. She's the mother of your child. Mm. It seems like you've got more of a connection. But anyway, yeah, it is a shitty hand. But also, I kind of want the writers to make the audience question a little bit. Mm. Is Xavier's definitely the right way? You know, because in the original series, it's clear, you know, even though you can tell Charles and Magnus, as they call him, you know, have this relationship going way back when. But Xavier's always the goodie, isn't he? Mm-hmm. And Magnus kind of flirts with going on the good side, but he's ultimately still that militant, anti-human sort of sentiment. So I want them to make us kind of question whether Magneto was right or not.
Yeah. Well, who knows what we're going to get? I mean, that's the beauty of this show. Again, that week-to-week speculation. You know, we wouldn't be having this conversation if it was a bingeable show, because everyone would have watched it in day one. So I like this. It's old school, isn't it? It's like that sort of weekly appointment television where you've got the whole week where everyone's thinking about it. Everyone's talking about the previous week, talking about what's going to happen, who might appear, who might die, you know, what might happen in next season, how might this season end. It's great stuff, and it's great to be able to converse about it and, you know, look forward to it. And yeah, I think we've sort of covered what we want to cover. And speaking of conversing, Dave, I really want to say thank you to you for stepping in and helping me out, you know, helping make sense of my inane ramblings and you bringing your eloquent turn of phrase to this show. I'm extremely grateful for you for stepping in, and I really look forward to you stepping in again next week. It's going to be a real treat for me. So thank you, Dave. Thank you very, very much for that. I really appreciate it.
No, thank you for inviting me on, and it's been great to sort of talk about the episode, but also kind of wide-ranging stuff as well. Mm. It's been brilliant, and we were wondering if we'd have enough to talk about, weren't we? But I can see that from the time, it's been a giant-sized episode, so there we go.
It has. So, yeah, thanks, Dave. Thanks very much, and thanks for Dan for sending your stuff over as well. We look forward to it again next week, buddy, and then seeing you back in 2 weeks' time. So yeah, thanks to everyone for listening. I hope you've enjoyed that. You can obviously catch us again next week on another episode of Examining X-Men 97. But for now, at least, we'll bid you farewell and safe travels out there. See you soon. Bye-bye.
Bye now. Do 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 do